All right, welcome. Good evening, everyone. Nice to see so many people here in the middle of week 8 of a term that is probably wearing everybody down. It's a pleasure. I'm Ken Shadlin from the Department of International Development. It's a pleasure to have Diego Sanchez Ancochea here tonight to talk about his book with Juliana Martinez Francione on the quest for universal social policy in the South. A project that I've been familiar with and talking to Diego about for years, and it's absolutely wonderful to see it out. There's some question as to whether it's actually been published, because nobody has seen a hard copy of the book, but word has it that it's available. Diego's going to talk for about 20 minutes or so. I asked Diego, 20 minutes, so that means 40 minutes, and he said, actually, no, 20 minutes means like 25 minutes. So Diego's going to talk for 25 minutes. And then Tasha Fairfield from Department of International Development is going to make some comments. And Tony Hall from the Department of Social Policy will comment as well. And then we should hopefully have plenty of time for Q&A and discussions and conversations and so on. Sorry, Diego. In addition to being one of my dearest friends, Diego is an associate professor in political economy of Latin America at Oxford University. He's in the Latin America Center, where he's actually the director of the Latin America Center, and he's also half-time, 50% in Queen Elizabeth House, Oxford's version of the Department of International Development, or maybe we're LSE's version of Queen Elizabeth's House. I'm not sure. But so he's Queen Elizabeth House, Development Studies, and Latin America Center. Diego, welcome. Congratulations on the book, and thanks for coming to LSE. And the floor is yours.
By thanking FIRSDIPA for the organization, much appreciated. It's a very, very nice pleasure to share with Tony and Tasha, at least now, after hearing their comments. It might be less of a pleasure, but I'll wait. But it's particularly a pleasure to receive the invitation from Ken. This fact that I'm here does have little to do with my book and a lot to do with my friendship with him, which I acknowledge in a book that does exist. I promise I wanted to bring. It's actually Ken, again, particularly if you like the book, he was our political science advisor. Neither Juliana nor I are political scientists, although the book has a lot on political science. And therefore, we felt a little bit like frauds. So I remember at least two or three times, one from Berlin, preparing an argument and sending it to Ken to say, does this make sense? And receiving all times the argument that yes, they did. So that gave us a lot of reassurance. So thank you very, very much for the invitation. What I do want to do is just give you very much the very brief summary of the book, because the fun part, of course, is to hear both of the discussants and also to receive questions and comments and have a nice discussion. So I'm really trying to with the 20 minutes. And as Ken said, this is very much a joint project with Juliana Martinez, who is a sociologist from Costa Rica, who I learned tremendously from in writing the book. So the starting point is to think about why universalism is important, why to think about universal social policy in the context of the South, although increasingly in every context it's important. And for those of you that work in Latin America, I think one of the ways to think about it is very much that the middle class, what we call the emergence middle class, has appeared as a key political actor in the region. So there has been a growth of at least 50%, according to the World Bank. Now what they call the middle class is the largest group within the region. I don't want to discuss whether it's a true middle class or not. The important thing is this is a group that doesn't have access to the anti-poverty policies that are the most popular in Latin America and in other parts of the world. And that creates a problem, because you have a set of the population that is actually right above the poverty line, that might be below the poverty line, particularly now that the region is in crisis, but that has much less rights to social policy, and thinking about how we actually give them social rights, it's important, and thinking about how we create coalitions between them and the poor becomes extremely important. And this, as they say, is particularly the case in contexts like Latin America, but other parts of the developing world, where GDP per capita is changing continuously, and whether people that might be now part of the emerging middle class is tomorrow part of the poor. And it doesn't make sense that today they don't have access to social rights, to health, to pensions and others, and tomorrow they do. And precisely because of that, we thought that it was extremely important to think about this issue. Of course, there's a second one, which is after two decades at least, in which social policy was very focused on anti-poverty programs and was very focalized, the last 15 years probably have led to an increasing accent, at least rhetorically, on universalism. And this is at the international level, so you have the discussion of the social protection floor by the ILO and others, but this is also in the context of Latin America, the different programs that have called themselves a universal. The question, of course, and the one we wanted to approach is, how do we secure universalism in the South? How would we think about promoting it? And I want to make, as I said, quite quickly, four different contributions or arguments. The first is about the definition of the term. The second is about the determinants. To then finish with a little bit about policy implications, or how we think about our approach in terms of policy. So let me start by defining it, because so far, the first 3 minutes of the talk, I have talked about universalism without defining it. And partly, this is the case because I don't think there's any agreement, or we don't think there's any agreement on that definition. And if you think about it in the context of developing countries, in the context of the South, there's actually two different ways of thinking about this. The first is universalism as coverage. So it's very much, if you want, a minimalist definition, in which we would say that social policy is universal if it covers everyone, even if it covers with very different benefits to different parts of the population. So we have, for example, the Mexican government celebrating reaching universalism in health because it had been able to create a program, Seguro Popular, for the poor, in parallel to social insurance for the middle class and the rich. But of course, we know that the benefits that different groups receive are very, very different, and therefore that you are talking about something that is nominally the case but not in practice. This contrasts with the literature in developed countries, which had a much more maximalist definition, if you want to use the term, around policy instruments. And if I ask those of you especially that don't work on developing countries what universal social policy is, you would think about the Scandinavian countries almost. And you would think that is a universal welfare system is one in which a majority of the population is covered with very generous benefits, which are funded through general taxes. And the problem with having two things is that both analytically but also politically, those two things get confused. So when President Calderón in Mexico said, wow, we have universal health, he is talking about this, but he is actually wanting the electorate to think very much about this, to think that they are becoming modern, that you are building a much more redistributed system. And that creates all kinds of confusions. But also, at the same time, thinking about how to reach in this in developing countries is extremely difficult. As Jennifer Prevel, a colleague of some of us, who wrote the book of universalism earlier than us, says, if we have to wait for Latin American countries to develop this kind of universalism, we can wait forever and ever. That would be very difficult. So what we try to think about is a definition that approaches this type of aims, but is actually more workable in the context of developing countries. And we do that by thinking about universalism, not university, sorry. I keep wanting to change this, but I'm thinking too much about the problems of the university in the UK. The universalism as a policy output. That is, it's about how you reach certain things, even if it's with a combination of policy instruments. If you think about health, the question is to separate how you have different ways of accessing health in countries with the actual results of all of those interventions coming together. So what are the aims or the policy outputs that you would want to achieve? Well, clearly one is massive coverage. That is, we will not talk about programs that are universal unless they cover a majority of the population. But, and this is the big difference with the minimalist definition, you also want certain level of generosity in type and quality. What do I mean by this? Is that you want schools where people want to be taught, and you want hospitals that are of a certain level, and also you want health systems that don't just cover for having a cold, but actually cover for cancer as well, and that they cover a majority of the population with the same benefits or very similar benefits. So at the end, we call a system universal when it actually covers a majority of the population with generous benefits that are similar for everyone. This is in contrast with segmentation, which is what characterizes many developing countries, in which either generosity is basic, so you are covering with something that is very basic for a majority of the population. Benefits are unequal, something that is very common in many Latin American countries, where different groups of the population have very different access to very different hospitals, for example. All coverage is uneven or variable, with different groups of the population being very different. Why it is this definition better? Well, because it focuses on what you want to achieve and not how you are going to achieve it. So it might be that you do this with a combination of social insurance and social assistance. The important thing is that those two things are sufficiently linked together to jointly lead to coverage, generosity, and relatively equal benefits. So that was my first, and I think the first, contribution, which is, as I say, much more on definitional grounds around how to think about universalism. And now the question is then, what are the factors that drive this type of output? And that's the second contribution. If you think about the literature, for example, in Latin America and other parts of the world, and I'm thinking here about the work of Hoover and Stevens, of Jenny Prevel and others, there's a big accent on democracy. So if you have democratic institutions, all kinds of good things will happen. The left will win elections. Governments will have to try to target the median voter, etc., which will lead to relatively good social policies for the majority of the population. The problem, of course, is that we know that many democracies in the developing world don't have universal outputs. And we also know that in the last 10 or 15 years in Latin America, for example, the arrival of the left led to very different results in terms of social policy. So obviously there are all kinds of mediating variables between having a democracy and having universalism. And even if we accept that universalism is a necessary condition, something that I would be very happy to discuss whether that's even the case in the questions and answers, but even if we accept that it's necessary, the question is what else do we need to achieve this kind of output? And to try to explore this question, what we did is concentrate on healthcare with pensions as a shadow case, that is, as a case of transfers, which we try to test whether what we found in health makes sense or not. We started by comparing four different countries, Uruguay, South Korea, Mauritius, and Costa Rica, which had high social investment at some point, but with very different levels of universal output. Here, a caveat, therefore, is we are not trying to understand, for example, whether you need to have certain level of state capacity or not. We are much more interested within the set of countries that could potentially develop universal policies because they have good institutions, etc., why some of them do and why some of them don't. The other mention is that the case, for those of you that work on South Korea, the case of South Korea might be the most controversial because for a long time it had a very unequal and non-generous social policy. The thing is that after having the transition to democracy, it's always used as an example of a very quick move towards universalism, which we question in terms of our output. And then the second part of the book is very much about analyzing with more detail the historical evolution of the Costa Rican case, because we think it's the most successful in terms of output of the four countries. And what is that we find, or what key variables we think are important? Well, we identify a key variable as the policy architectures. That is, as a set of instruments that define how we provide a particular policy, in this case, health. To be clear about what I mean is, if I had to ask you, how do we define a policy? How do we define the things that, if you are a policymaker, need to define how you are providing something? We have five components. The key four ones are funding. So how do you fund that policy? Is it through payroll taxes? Is it through general taxes? Is it through out-of-pocket contributions? But obviously, you need to define that in terms of the architecture of the policy. Who has access and why? Do people have access because they are citizens? Do people have access because they are poor? Do people have access because they are workers? And therefore, and that's the second principle you have to define. The third is what benefits you are, how you are defining benefits and how much benefits you are giving them. So for example, in health, do you have a list of things that enter, or do you actually, in principle, give the right to every single service? And that you also need to define in the way you are going to provide. And of course, the last one is, who will be the providers? Will the provider be just the public sector? Will it be also the NGO sector or the private sector as well? Those four things together define how the public sector is providing a service. And the interesting thing is that, of course, you can combine the different programs that you have in health, all of them together, to analyze how together they define the architecture. There's a fifth component, and one of the things that we also think we are contributing to, which is thinking about the public sector always in conversation with what is happening in the private sector. So those of you that work in developing countries or are from developing countries know that in places like Argentina or Brazil, if you define what is happening in the public sector without at the same time telling us and thinking about what are private providers doing with private insurance, etc., you will not have a full picture of how different groups of the population have access to health. And therefore, you will not have a full picture of how much there are coalitions, for example, political coalitions around servicing those services. So all of those things together will define the policy architecture, and different policy architectures will lead to very different levels of universalism in terms of output. To be more specific, when we go to the four countries, we find very different architectures. So what is interesting, so one that is particularly interesting is Mauritius, because in many ways Mauritius would be the most similar to the Scandinavian model. Since slightly earlier than independence, what Mauritius did was create something similar to the NHS in the UK, so you had access to health based with general taxes. So in principle, that would be the closest to universalism. The thing is, however, because there was at the same time a relatively large market alternative of private hospitals, you had very large segments of the middle class only accessing this. And therefore, you have you have fragmentation as a result of this difference between the private and public sector. And we argue you cannot talk then about universalism as an output, because you have the middle class and other groups having access to very different levels of health, one private and one public. Uruguay is a very clear case of the Latin American problem of having a lot of different social insurance funds in which different groups of the population enter. Korea is similar, but with a very large market alternative as well. And Costa Rica is the one which developed a single social insurance system for the whole population, which also has a single provider, which is the public sector. And we argue that this higher level of unification leads to better outcomes in terms of universals. Let me see if I can cover in the four minutes that I have. The other interesting thing of the policy architectures, I have said one that I propose and I hope find interesting, is this issue of incorporating the outside option. The other is that it's an instrument that allows us to link the short term with the long term in an explanation that has a lot of path dependence. So a policy architecture today defines not only what is happening today, but also the political trajectory that might follow in the long run. So you have that initial architectures will create opportunities and constraints that will then move the countries towards more unification or less. This sounds rather theoretical. Let me put an example comparing Uruguay and Costa Rica of what I have in mind. So you have that the Costa Rican social insurance system began by incorporating blue-collar workers, and by this I mean formal workers, but with relatively low level of wages. And it did it to a single fund, as I was saying. And that meant that at the beginning it was not universal, in the sense that only a few groups of the population were included. However, the incentives you created was to incorporate others in the future. Why? Because when there were funding problems, which all social insurance programs have, the incentive was to incorporate the rich and force the rich to also become part of the system. This is very different to the Uruguayan case, where you started with white-collar workers, so I'm thinking here about the military, public servants, teachers, which had then very little incentive to expand the system to the poor, right? The last thing they wanted is to share their hospitals or their pensions with the poor. And therefore, you created a trajectory, a set of incentives toward expanding the services that these groups got. So maybe you had to increase payroll taxes but also increase their services instead of incorporating the poor. Moreover, the poor were in general in a parallel system that was the public sector, which spent less per person than this one. So our argument is that when we think about how to build universalism, you need to think about how to design architectures, not only thinking about the short term, but thinking also about the political trajectories and the type of incentives that you might create towards more or less unification of the system. And that meant that Costa Rica, precisely because of that, has a tendency to incorporate all into the same system, while in Uruguay we have the type of fragmentation that I was discussing over the long run. There, let me also say, this is not a deterministic explanation. In that sense, for those of you that work in dependence, it's a relatively weak notion of path dependence in the sense that we think this, that architectures constrains what actors can do and how actors think about social policy. But of course, there's always a lot of room for maneuver within those constraints. Now, the big question is, how are these policy architectures designed initially and reformed later? And that's the second part of the book. What it does is to go over the case of Costa Rica precisely to define who are the key actors. And remember, here we are not talking about the whole social policy. We are not trying to explain why governments might spend more or less on social policy. We really are trying to explain why some governments have some policy architectures and others other. And we argue, and I wish if I had the 40 minutes that Ken offered, but I didn't take, that I could explain a little bit more the Costa Rican case, but basically put a lot of accent on state actors. And we see that at every time of both the design and development of architectures over time, state actors that had three characteristics, either political leadership themselves, in the 1970s they were ministers, or political support from the president. Second, that they brought international ideas to the table. In the 1940s, the social insurance was designed by a group of just three or four people in Costa Rica that went to Chile and learned a lot from the Chilean case, and that also are capable of managing the potential beaters that exist. We can go over, again, our idea is not that any state actor can create this. we realize, and we have done other work in the past, that you might have certain social preconditions, but we are calling for the literature to pay more attention also to the specific actors that are designing those policies. So let me conclude, instead of giving you a big conclusion, a big analysis, doing a different exercise instead of doing a standard summary, which is think about a new social policy that a developing country might want to implement. So think, for example, about childcare, which many developing countries, at least in Latin America, are now trying to think seriously about how to create. What would be the type of lesson or the type of thing that we would indicate with our own analysis if you want to promote universal policies? The first is that you should try to unify the policy architecture as much as possible. What do I mean by this is that you shouldn't concentrate just on expanding coverage as quickly as you can, maybe with NGOs in this part of the country, with the private sector and subsidies in this other, with the private sector in this other one. You might be willing to be slower, but trying to make a way of either having the same provider for every part of the country, or at least put a lot of emphasis on supervision and governance of the system. Second, that you need to think about what are the potential trajectories of the system and not just how you design initially. For example, if you do, as many countries, start by just incorporating the very poor, you run the risk of consolidating a childcare system that is seen as just for the poor. And therefore, it will be much tougher in the future to try to convince the middle class to introduce them as well. Third, that managing the outside option, that as important as expanding childcare facilities is, how you regulate the private facilities that already exist will be nearly as important or more. And fourth, although less important maybe for policy, more for the analysis, that whether you do all of these things will not only depend on political parties, democratic institutions, big processes, but will also depend on whether the country is able to develop or has a techno-political class that is progressive and is able to think strategically as about some of these issues. So I said 25 minutes, I did in 24, so thank you very, very much. Mm-hmm.